So this is talking with Charles Towns on 23rd September 1981 at Berkeley about aspects of his career in radio, when it touched on radio astronomy before the early 1960s. You got your degree in physics, I would assume. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Can you tell me where and when?
Yes, I got my degree at Caltech and finished in 1939.
And were you already involved in microwave spectroscopy kind
of
things?
No, I wasn't at all. I did some work on the separation of isotopes and then the spectroscopic measurement of their spins, the spectroscopy in the visible region.
Mm-hmm.
So I was involved in spectroscopy, but not in microwaves at all. I went from there to Bell Telephone Laboratories, initially working in some sort of surface phenomenon and lepton tube phenomena. Then the war came along, and I was very quickly assigned the job of developing radar bombing systems, and through that got interested in
radio techniques.
Experience in radar.
I see. Now, when was the first time you can remember hearing about radio astronomy?
Well, the first time I heard about radio astronomy, it wasn't a hearing, it was a reading. It was back in my undergraduate days. I was an undergraduate at Furman University from 1931 to 1935. And I remember reading in some book, a physics book, which had a few of sort of the latest discoveries.
Mm-hmm.
I remember reading of Jansky's discovery of the radio waves coming in from outer space. And it was commented that nobody had any explanation for these, but so on, and I was quite fascinated by that, so it's stuck in my mind a long time. I've since tried to figure out just what book that was, and I haven't located it.
But yeah, I don't know if any mention of it.
I remember the words very well. I remember reading about it, and I was...
An undergraduate physics textbook.
Yes, yeah.
Huh.
That's right.
Interesting.
That's right. It was... and to me, you know, it was very exciting to hear something, to read about something like that. And furthermore, it wasn't explained at the time. Nobody understood it. And so during World War II, I was doing a lot of basically engineering work, engineering design, systems design, testing of radar bomb sites and airplanes. And we had long periods when the airplane wouldn't fly or something like this. And I wanted to do pure science in the long run, and I didn't mind doing engineering during the war because I felt that was important and appropriate. But I decided, well, with the time between breakdowns of the airplane and times when we couldn't fly, I'd try to do something, pick up some problem in physics and work on it. And so this work of Jansky's occurred to me, and I thought, well, if that's not yet understood, it would be, I'll see if I can figure out what can possibly be causing that radiation.
But now, it occurred to you from reading 10 years before, and
that's
not
correct,
because
yes.
You were at Bell Labs and
no.
You talked to anybody there, I see.
No, it occurred to me from reading before, and I suppose also because I was doing radar work at the time, and hence dealing with radio waves,
yeah.
I had done
right.
a good deal of work on generation of radio waves also. My early days at Bell Telephone Laboratories, I'd invented several different ways of producing microwaves and so on, and so it was an area that was familiar to me, but it wasn't because of anybody particularly at Bell
yeah.
Telephone Laboratories. It was just something that I realized was what seemed to me a fascinating problem and not understood and be a good thing to think about.
When you came up with the idea, did you know about Reber's measurements?
Let me see. No, I didn't know about Reber's measurements at that time. No. I was in the field, mostly down in Florida, testing from an Air Force base down in Florida. I'm not entirely sure. Did I know about Reber's work? I don't think so. I think when I came back to Bell Laboratories and started talking with people about it, particularly people down in Homedale, Southworth and others, I think they mentioned Reber's work.
Sure.
And I immediately then looked it up and got in touch with Reber. And I think that's how it came about,
right.
But I'm not certain.
But now, what year is this we're talking about, roughly?
Well, this would have been about 1943 or 4, probably Yeah, probably 43 or 4. It was during the war that I worked this out. The war finished in 45. I had written it all down, worked it out, and talked to my colleagues about it and so on.
Before the end of the war, you had pretty much what turned out to be this paper in Apjay in 47.
That's right. And you probably realize that the people who were doing the work at that time were engineers, primarily. They were good engineers, and they understood a good deal of physics, but nevertheless, they weren't oriented in the same way that I was.
Right.
For that reason, I looked over the papers. Southworth had been making measurements on the sun and on other things, and that was very exciting too. And so I read all of his papers. And
did you know about Hayes' discovery, which was circulating as a secret report during the war?
Hayes.
Well, J.S. Hay was the one who first detected the burst radiation at VHF. In England, in 42, actually.
I think I did. I remember knowing about Hayes' work fairly early in the game, but exactly when I learned about it first, I don't know. But on the other hand, people like Southworth must have known about it.
I would think they would have.
I talk with Southworth every once in a while. I visited down at Holmdel, not infrequently anyhow, because of my radar work, and I would see Southworth down there and talk to him about it. And
Jansky, so, I mean, he was there still.
Yes, yeah. Jansky was not terribly active, really, in the radar region. He was, I think, still involved in somewhat longer waves and maybe receivers or something, and I've forgotten exactly what he was doing.
No, I think that's right. He was working in nature of noise and interference at low frequencies.
Right. So his work and mine didn't really cross paths very much, but Holmdel was a small place in those days. And so you'd see everybody there, and I'd see Jansky around, and of course when I talked to him casually about these things, and of course I'm very, very pleased to know him as he made this very important discovery. But he was a quiet person, and off in another field, and he's glad to talk about what he'd done or anything, but he was not... he was not a gregarious type, and whereas Southworth was still very active in the field and in microwaves, and I had to see him for other reasons anyhow, having to do with radar and so on, so I interacted with him a little bit more. And Reber, the papers I just read, although I met Reber a few times, I think perhaps at meetings only.
He may have come. It must have been after the war, probably.
Yeah, after the war.
We just found some correspondence that you had with him.
But as I say, these people are primarily engineers, so some of the physics was not all that clear to them, and that also made it clear to me that maybe I could contribute something there, and so I worked on various problems, and I think in particular the interpretation, both the Reber and Southworth, the interpretation in terms of actual temperatures and radiation effects was not quite correct.
Right. Well, you came across this just plain error in Southworth's factor of 4 or something.
I guess
as soon as you began working on that.
Yeah, that's right. And some of Reber's interpretations of how to express this in terms of black body radiation and so on were not quite correct either.
Right.
I've forgotten what that
but
was.
Well, I'd be interested in your opinion as to, in Reber's 39, his first publication in the standard literature of the fact that he had a dish and he made some measurements at 160 megahertz. He brings up free radiation as a reasonable mechanism and goes through some numbers which one can find errors in. I think in particular he forgot about the Gaunt factor entirely in the equations. But I'd be interested in your opinion as to Reber's insight as to what might be going on out there. Was this just a lucky guess be your impression, or do you think
I suppose Reber was very intuitive, and he had ways of describing the radiation. You read his papers, you know, they're very poetic in a sense.
Yes, exactly.
Talk about the great rushing of noise and all of this.
Yes,
and so
right.
And that's the way he went about things. He was not quantitative, really, and mathematical. And I don't know. I don't remember that particular reference to free radiation. I'm sure I read it at some point, but I don't remember it now, so I can't really comment on it much. Anyhow, he was an intuitive guy who had lots of ideas, some right, some wrong, and he was very creative. There were, in fact, after I started working on this and had more or less worked it out, then I began to find more and more several places where people had worked on this and had somewhat similar ideas, but they just hadn't really done it quite right.
Henyey and Keenan, you mean?
Yes, right.
1940.
I had, in fact, I had it all worked out, and I presented this, because I talked to my friends at Bell Laboratories, and I think I probably gave a talk or two on it then. So one of my friends at Bell Laboratories, I believe, mentioned, I think it was, came up this way, that one of my friends mentioned the Dutch physicist work on X-rays. No, the X-ray.
Kramer's?
Yes, Kramer's X-ray paper. And said, well, you know, that sounds kind of similar to the Kramer's X-ray.
So that's where this reference came in.
Yeah, that's right. So I had it all worked out, and then once I saw Kramer's work, well, I cut down.
You had done it completely independently.
Right. I did it completely independently. When I saw Kramer's work, well, I just slashed out a lot of my own development and sort of referred to that. Because while it was a completely different wavelength region, and you know the parameters were all different, and so on. The theory was basically similar, I referred to that. But then there were other papers. Now, Henyey and Keenan. It seems to me there were two papers. I believe Henyey's tried to do a quantum mechanical development of it.
They extended the theory from the optical, which was quite familiar to them, to the radio.
And in doing that, they didn't do it quite right, so they came up with something which involved Planck's constant, and what clearly I recognized had to be a classical thing. Yeah. Planck's constant couldn't possibly enter in. Mm-hmm. There was another development. I'm not sure now just who did it.
There's no other reference. I was just looking at what you refer to here as far as theoretical development. Now, it turns out that during the war, Henk van der Holst did work out completely the sort of Henyey and Keenan sort of thing, but you wouldn't have known about that paper.
I didn't know about that.
It wasn't published till after the war, and then only in Dutch.
There was something else. I think maybe Menzel had worked out something, which he showed to me privately.
Well, and we just saw some correspondence with Menzel there.
There was something.
What you're thinking of.
There's something either Menzel or Whipple. Mm-hmm. I talked with Menzel.
There's a Whipple and Greenstein paper that was since 1937.
Oh, that's probably
indeed. What I was thinking. Trying to explain Jansky's results as hot dust.
Yes. Uh-huh. Well.
And they said it just can't be that hot when they worked out in essence.
No, it wasn't that. It was some other free approximation.
Free, I see.
I think, I believe it might have been just an informal calculation that Menzel or Whipple, one or the other, had done.
Anyway, you found out about
I found other people who were working on it, but nobody had really done it quite right. Now, it happens that Henyey's result numerically isn't all that.
That's right, it's
all
close.
That far off, somewhat by accident. And when I wrote the paper, you'll see in this correspondence, when I wrote the paper, I carefully made the same development, kind of development Henyey did, and pointed out just where the error was. To point out that this really had to be classical, and just exactly where the error was, and to show that his initial approach itself wasn't wrong. And if you did it right, it came out the same answer that I had. That Greenstein, you know how papers get reviewed. I don't know who reviewed this, but anyhow, it came back saying, well, that nobody's interested in proving that quantum mechanics and classical mechanics can't agree, and all of this should be cut out. Well, I didn't think I was trying to prove that. I thought I was trying to show where the earlier calculation had gone wrong, and that in fact, if you do it that way, it's perfectly all right, you see. But because of that, I said, well, okay, I cut out a lot of that, and demonstrating exactly what what the error was in his type of calculation. So as I figured it out more or less ab initio, and then I began to find, which is typically the case, you find other people have done somewhat similar things along the route. I talked with Menzel, and Menzel felt that, well, they really understood that at Harvard, and then he showed me some calculations, but again, it was a very broad kind of approximation, as I remember, and didn't really quite.
That's interesting. I've never heard about Menzel doing anything at that stage.
Well, it was either Menzel or Whipple. And I know he called in Whipple and said, we know about this, don't we? And
tell me we do, Fred.
But I looked at the material and decided, well, it really was not the real, not quite the real thing, and I ought to go ahead and publish.
Well, you touched on a couple of things I'd like to ask about. First of all, you have mentioned Harold Freese, who presumably you were seeing when you went to Home Bell also.
Yes, I remember once in a while.
And I wondered if you, having been around Bell Labs at that time, had any opinion on a controversy, in essence, that has developed as to whether Jansky was suppressed by Freese in some sense, that Jansky really wanted to continue following up on his radio astronomy, and Freese kept putting him on very practical matters. Do you have any information?
I have no direct information. I knew Freese quite well. He's perfectly capable of doing that, I would say. You know, he was an engineer who kept his eye on the ball. He's a very good engineer, but he ran the group. Let me say, that doesn't seem out of character to me, but I have no direct information.
And it is true. I mean, I have many other bits of evidence about Jansky's character, as you've already indicated, being rather retiring.
Yeah.
Not a very forceful very personality.
Very modest person. Who just, he was interested in things and he kept plugging along. But he didn't push himself.
Right. Did you ever see any of Southworth's equipment that he used for solar observations, or see him observing or anything like that?
I don't think I ever saw him observing, but I certainly saw his equipment, sure. Mm-hmm. I saw his equipment and was talking about it. And I knew Southworth. I'd met Southworth before the war because I was doing some microwave things, and when I first came there, I met Southworth and went down home before the war. So I was away for long periods of time, but otherwise in reasonably good contact with that group of people. But Jansky was so retiring that you didn't see him unless you suddenly looked him up.
Seek him out, I see. Yeah.
Well, you'd see him in passing, but he was just very quiet.
Well, if I could ask you just a couple of specific questions in this paper. First of all, I'm surprised that you were able to get agreement with the free-free theory, given the six or seven data points at different frequencies that you had, albeit with a very high temperature, 150,000 kelvins, but I was somewhat surprised that still the spectral shape worked out, because shortly thereafter it wasn't working out very well, and I haven't had a chance to go back and see. It must have been some assumption. I mean, there was a lot of discussion, and it was a very tricky thing, and I've tried to do this myself.